The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Cox IV versus Lesser Surgical Ablations is presented by Dr. Rachel Harrison.
Thanks for having me. Let's see if we get my slides up. Like Dr. Cooley said, I'm from Memphis. I emphasize mostly in cardiac surgery and heart failure surgery with LVAD and transplant as a major part of my practice. So the objectives of my talk, if we could, do I have power of this here? There we go, okay. Are gonna be to understand the impact of AFib on our medical community, discuss the principles of surgical ablation compared to transcatheter ablation, which you just heard about, and describe the ablation lesions in the full biatrial Cox maze 4, a limited left-sided maze, and then the PVI, pulmonary vein isolation. Then discuss the outcomes, both positive and negative, and identify which patients qualify for different types of treatment. So normally, in normal sinus rhythm, you have a trigger that's generated at the SA node, which then goes down the atria, down to the AV node, and then generates a regular rhythm in the ventricles. In AFib, you have loss of that SA nodal activity, and you have multiple signals across the atria that then trigger some quivering motion, which generates lack of movement of blood, which sets you up for thrombosis risk. And then some of those signals get crossed over into the ventricles, and then you get an irregular rhythm in your ventricles, and you have disconcordant contraction of each left and right ventricles, which ultimately ends up leading into the heart failure type picture. In AFib, it's initiated usually by a spontaneously generated electrical impulse in either area of the sinus node, areas other than the sinus node. Typically, this is around the pulmonary vein. When it's mapped, it looks like a bright star, and you can see there on the left the little red areas. That's the most common area. And after AFib's been induced by a focal trigger, the atria begin to remodel, and then you develop these macro reentry circuits you can see on the right. These are called rotors. And then that leads on to developing sustained AFib. Unlike the focal trigger on the left, a rotor doesn't have a specific site of origin and doesn't remain stationary. So when mapped, these appear more like a tornado. Patients can experience symptoms of palpitations, a racing heartbeat, or a pounding heart that's more pronounced with a fast heart rate. The inability of the atrium to contract decreases your cardiac output by 20%, and this prevents effective forward blood flow, ultimately leading to symptoms of heart failure, dizziness, shortness of breath, hypotension, and fatigue. When blood doesn't flow forward in the atria, typically in the left atrial appendage, it can pool, and these patients are at risk for getting clot, and 95% of the thrombi form in the left atrial appendage, which is why we focus so much on that part of the heart. And this is thought to maybe happen in as short as 5 minutes of AFib. The clot can then embolize into the systemic circulation. It's thought that maybe 20% of ischemic strokes are thought to be due to AFib emboli. Prolonged AFib ultimately results in volume overload, dilatation of the atria from scarring within the atrial wall. This is called atrial remodeling. This further disrupts the normal anatomic conduction pathway and then can lead into chronic AFib. The stretching also causes dilation of the mitral and tricuspid valves, giving you mitral regurgitation, and then that leads into further volume overload and heart failure, and then just the downward spiral that follows. If left uncorrected, AFib can result in heart failure, volume overload, remodeling, and then chronic tachycardia. The ventricle that also has to work harder because you've lost 20% of your cardiac output. And the development of valvular regurgitation worsens this even further. These changes at this point are typically irreversible. This is a huge impact on our medical community. About 6.1 million people have AFib in the United States. This is expected to double in the next 15 to 25 years. 9% of patients over the age of 65 have AFib, and 2% of patients under the age of 65 have AFib. This contributes to about $26 billion of U.S. healthcare monies. And patients with AFib have a 5 times increased risk of stroke, 3 times increased risk of CHF, and a 2 times increased risk of mortality. The medical costs for a patient with AFib are over $8,000 per year. So you can see this is pretty important for us to focus on. AFib has had many classifications. It can be a little confusing, so I'm just going to go through these really quickly. Based on the 2014 ACC-AHA guidelines, we base our diagnosis of AFib on the following. So paroxysmal AFib is AFib that has developed spontaneously or within an intervention and is relieved within 7 days. Goes away by itself. And then persistent AFib is that which goes on beyond 7 days. Long-standing persistent AFib is longer than 12 months. Permanent AFib is a diagnosis that's reached by the patient and the clinician, at which point they have decided to no longer pursue treatment. And our thoughts on how we treat AFib may modify how we call things permanent AFib. Non-valvular AFib is basically any type of AFib that is not related to a valvular pathology. So electrical physiologic mapping studies have determined that paroxysmal AFib is caused by one or more focal triggers, typically around the pulmonary veins. If not converted into sinus rhythm, as I mentioned before, these rotors develop and you get the more refractory non-paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. And these are the two types that kind of diverge in terms of our treatment. Right now, I'll just go through the guidelines on how we manage these patients medically. As a reference, rate control, we've already heard about, is usually the first line of therapy, and this is beta blocker and medication controlled. The downside of using rate control as your only therapy is that it's important to note that these patients still have fibrillating atria, so you're only treating the rapid ventricular response. This approach can decrease the symptoms and the morbidity associated with AFib, but patients still have the underlying issues of atrial fibrillation. In order to prove that you've treated them correctly with symptomatic control, you should do exercise testing, and that's a recommendation. The next line of therapy, in addition to rhythm control, is AV nodal ablation. This is a catheter-based therapy, which is associated with usually a concomitant placement of a pacemaker. This decreases their cardiac output by 15 to 20% because you automatically remove any kind of atrial contribution to the cardiac output and are depending only on the ventricular speed of the heart. This, again, does not decrease stroke risk. It doesn't prevent atrial remodeling, and it doesn't stop the progression of AFib affecting the mitral valve or the progression of mitral regurgitation. So rate control is sort of a substandard approach compared to the other options that we have. So next is rhythm control. This can be achieved with medications. The attempt here is to convert the patient back into normal sinus rhythm to improve symptoms and decrease the risk of emboli, remodeling, heart failure, all of the things I've mentioned. This therapy is more successful when it's implemented early, and there can be a survival benefit to this, although the side effects of the drugs negate the survival benefit of the rhythm of the rate control comparatively, so they kind of cancel each other out. So you can't make an assumption based on rhythm versus rate in terms of survival benefit. The next option would be electrocardioversion. Again, this has a higher chance of success if you've caught it before the atria have started their remodeling process. So usually, electrocardioversion is best in the first 6 months of the diagnosis. Overall, it has a less than 50% chance of success. And after a significant period of sinus rhythm, if a patient converts back into AFib, you can try it again. With regard to anticoagulation recommendations, we evaluate the risk based on the CHADS-VASc score. A score of 2 or greater is considered high risk for stroke, and that anticoagulation is indicated. Even with AFib and anticoagulation, the risk of stroke is still 1.6% per year. Another table that on the left is the CHADS-VASc score, I'm sure everyone knows. On the right is the Has-Bled score. This kind of gives us a risk of major bleeding event while on anticoagulation therapy. A score of 3 or greater is considered high risk for bleeding. This hasn't reached into any of the guidelines yet. It's still not used, but it's just a neat little tool. Progression to catheter ablation is indicated for those symptomatic patients who failed your medical therapies. Endocardial ablation using radiofrequency or cryo catheters can burn the tissue and convert it to scar. We kind of talked about this already. Following the ablation procedures, these patients remain on their AFib medications, but recurrence is higher due to a phenomenon called reconnection where the scar is incomplete and electrical signals can leak through, and then they get recurrence of their AFib. Catheter ablation carries about an 80% long-term success in paroxysmal AFib. This is great for that stationary focal trigger. The success in non-paroxysmal AFib is lower. It's about 30% long-term. And it takes multiple ablation procedures. You saw that one slide with the multiple steps in the FIRM ablation study. It's just a treatment. It's estimated this takes up about 15 hours of EP time. You can get up to about a 50% success rate on that. And the thought about it being lower successful is thought that there may be generation of new triggers during that process from the atrial remodeling and the constant motion of those atrial rotors. With regard to surgical ablation, the STS recently released updated guidelines recommending surgical ablation for AFib at the time of concomitant mitral, aortic, and CABG procedures. This can be done without an increase in operative morbidity or mortality, so it's very strongly recommended in patients with non-paroxysmal AFib. And it's also reasonable to perform primary standalone surgical ablation in patients with symptomatic AFib. The principles of surgical ablation are similar to the endocardial and the catheter-based ablation therapies in terms of you want to get a full-thickness scar, so electrical signals for conduction can get through epicardially, endocardially, and everywhere in between. So you need a complete full-thickness scar. The potential locations of the rotors have been mapped by EP studies over the course of decades. And unlike catheter ablation, surgical ablation seeks to address all of the rotors, all the potential locations to eliminate current and future development of AFib rotors. And full ablation lines act like walls in the heart so that as the rotation of the electrical signal progresses, it hits that wall and then it has to progress elsewhere. The Cox-Maze IV surgery is the most up-to-date version of what we do for complete surgical ablation. It used to be a cut-and-sew technique, and with the newer technology of radiofrequency ablation and cryoablation, we've been able to minimize or lessen the amount of sewing that we have to do in the procedure. Exit block testing is performed on the pulmonary veins to ensure adequacy of our treatment. Briefly, the procedure is divided into two sides, so we address the left side and then the right side, and I'll just go through the procedure really quickly. That's the right-sided lesions, and I'll zoom in on these here. So I do my procedure a little bit differently than probably most people in order to save pump time and cross-clamp time. If feasible, I try to perform the right-sided pulmonary vein isolation off pump. The setup for the case is a standard distal ascending aortic cannulation, bicaval venous drainage, and that gives you a nice view of the right atrium and the left atrium. Perform the right pulmonary vein isolation, and then go on pump, decompress the heart, and perform the left pulmonary vein isolation. At this point, I'll leave the heart full and open the left atrium. No cross clamp just yet. Open the left atrial appendage and perform the connecting lesion between the left atrial appendage and the pulmonary veins on the left side, and then occlude the left atrial appendage with AtriCure AtriClip, which is shown on the left side of the screen. Then I set up my cryoprobe to perform the coronary sinus lesion towards the mitral valve, and have my assistant hold the cryoablation probe because it takes like 2 minutes. That's wasted time. So while that's going on, I'll go on and finish the rest of the left-sided lesions with the RFA probe. Do the superior and inferior box, and I've skipped on the last slide. There's also a P2-P3 RFA lesion that you perform. And that's the end of the left-sided maze, and then we convert over to the right-sided maze. Usually the clamp is off at this point, and the heart's beating, so that if you do induce heart block, you can detect it during the maze. These are the incisions performed, or the ablation and incisions performed on the right atrium. The right atrium is opened, and you perform a superior and inferior vena cava RFA ablation, and then you finish it off with cryoablation towards the tricuspid valve in the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock position. Ultimately, all of that ends up looking like this. And there's actually a nice little checklist from the AtriCure reps that they give you to make sure you haven't forgotten anything. And what this does for you is it creates a maze through which the electrical signals must pass in order to get to the AV node. And that's what it looks like at the end. So on the left are your rotors, and on the right is your maze. With regard to the left atrial appendage, the AtriClip provided by AtriCure is a device that we use. It's used from the outside, and it seats at the base of the left atrial appendage. Over time, the appendage shrivels up, and this is a very successful technique, and it's very safe. That's the picture of the AtriClip. It's a cartoon. And it's recommended that you do this on every maze procedure. There's some studies going on right now to look at isolated left atrial appendage in the setting of left atrial appendage closure in the setting of other surgeries. So I think the jury's still out on that. With regard to post-op care, 15 to 30% of these patients develop fluid retention, so diuresis is required. 40% of patients will get tachyarrhythmias early on, and so we circumvent this by keeping them on amiodarone postoperatively, unless there's a reason not to do that. All patients get aspirin and Coumadin with a goal INR of 2 to 2.5, and the need for a permanent pacemaker is more common if they have a pre-op SA nodal issues, and we'll just monitor that. Usually we'll give them a week for things to settle down before we decide to put a pacemaker in. These patients are followed for at least 2 years. We see them at 3 months after the first initial post-op visit, and then follow them every 6 months for 2 years. Usually they can come off of some of their anticoagulation and their antiarrhythmic drugs. So we define success as freedom from any atrial tachyarrhythmias. Just a couple of studies to prove efficacy of the procedure. This study shows that treatment of concomitant AFib results in patients remaining in normal sinus rhythm following surgery at 10 years. This shows that they have a good quality of life. This may be due to the improvement of their congestive heart failure type symptoms, because patients who have improved congestive heart failure, improved cardiac output, also have an improved quality of life. This study shows that patients who have their concomitant AFib treated at the time of surgery have fewer strokes due to AFib over the next 12 years. And there are fewer long-term thromboembolic and valve-related events as well. The same study also showed a significant decrease in all complications over a 12 to 13 year period in patients who had other procedures in addition to their concomitant AFib. And if you compare patients who had a concomitant MAIS at the time of a cardiac surgery, they had similar long-term survival compared to patients who had no AFib preoperatively. Thank you.